Now, the first thing I want to do is thank you all for showing up, even though it's study day. I have brought the handouts from the last two times, just in case you don't have them, because I have a lot in my office, in the hall. And they're over here. You don't need them for today's lecture. But in case you didn't manage to get the last two, they're over there, and if you want to get them at the end. And the one for today is here in the back. Now, the first thing I want to do is continue what we were talking about last time, which was linkage and crossing over. And we explained the idea, but today I want to look at it more carefully. And I think we should step back a bit and consider, how do you detect or define linkage versus independent assortment? We discussed last time that you generate a double heterozygote, which can be either big A, big B on one chromosome, little a, b on the other, or it can be big A, little b, little a, big A. Then what you do is you look at the products of meiosis. And you classify the products of meiosis, the haploids, as either parental or recombinant. Now, what will be parental and what will be recombinant will depend on what the parent is, the heterozygote. But you count up parentals and recombinants. For example, in the second case, what would big A, big B be? That would be a recombinant. So you count them all up. Now, if you get equal numbers of the two, if parental equals recombinant, total number of parentals approximately equal to the number of recombinants, or the ratio is 1, then you say you have independent assortment. On the other hand, if you have more parentals than recombinants, then you say you have linkage. Now let's see what this means. More parentals than recombinants means that the combinations which you started with tend to stick together, and you get more of them than of the alternative. Equal numbers of parental and recombinants means that either allele of A was equally likely to go with either allele of B. So the A's are acting independently of the B's, and that's why we call it independent assortment. Now, you can't get more parentals than recombinants from many meioses, as we will see. What we are talking about here is not looking at the products of a single meiosis one at a time. We're looking at many gametes or spores from many meioses. And if you look at the pooled results of many meioses, you can't get more recombinants than parentals. It's impossible for reasons that we'll explain. Now, let me just say right off the bat that there are two ways of getting independent assortment. The obvious one is the one we talked about last time. If the A's are on one pair of homologs and the B's are on another. But it is also possible, if the A's and B's are very far apart on the same chromosome, maybe I should draw it like this, then the A's and the B's essentially will get scrambled during meiosis by crossing over, and either A is just as likely to go with either B. And we'll explain again how that's possible. Now, what we want to look at, however, is the fine points of linkage. We understand independent assortment, but there are variations in the amounts of linkage. All I said here is linkage is more parentals than recombinants. But you could get all parentals, 95% parentals, 60% parentals. How do you deal with that, and what does it mean in terms of linkage? So we have to define a way of measuring linkage. What we do is, starting with a heterozygote, go through meiosis and count up the products of meiosis as parental or recombinant. And then we define the recombination frequency, or the RF, is equal to the percent recombinance. Which means you count up the recombinants, the recombinant haploids that came out of meiosis, you put that over the total haploids, and you multiply by 100. And that's called the recombination frequency. Now, notice, this is the result of many meioses, not the result of one. It might be better to look at the result of single meioses, but you can almost never do that. In most experimental situations, you have to look at the results of many meioses, and that's why people use the recombination frequency. Now, within the proper range, within the proper limits, the recombination frequency between A and B, the recombination frequency within proper limits is proportional to the distance between A and B. So RF is proportional to distance. Maybe we should write RF between A and B is proportional to the distance from A to B within proper limits. And what we want to look at today is what those limits are and why it only works within certain limits. And then we'll see how you use the fact that recombination frequency is a measure of distance to make a genetic map. Now, probably the easiest way to understand this is to consider a whole bunch of cases. Now, all of this is in your notes, but not necessarily in the exact order in which I'm going to say it. And I found a few typos in the notes this morning, and I corrected them in the HTML version, and the PDF will be corrected later, and they're marked in blue. Most of them are trivial. Okay. So let's consider the possibility. You may notice on your handout for today, there is a graph on the bottom. And that graph on side A shows how recombination frequency goes as a function of distance. So you're measuring the recombination frequency between A and B as A and B get further and further apart. So we could have this situation, and then they get a little further apart, and then they get a little further apart, until finally we end up with them very far apart. So we want to consider what happens. As that distance increases, the recombination frequency is linear to begin with, but then it flattens out and plateaus at 50%. Now, how do you get a result like this? What happens if A and B are very close together? If A and B are very close together, if you look at the results of many meioses, most of the meioses now, if you look at the top of your handout, are going to be type 1. Last time on our big handout, we had a more detailed version of type 1 and type 2. That is, we said that if you start out with A and B on the same chromosome, big AB on one homologue, little AB on the other, you double the DNA. And if you go through meiosis with no crossover, then you get four gametes, or four spores, four haploid products of meiosis, which are exactly the same as what we started with, two of each. So in fact, you get all parentals. If A and B are a little further apart, then some meioses have a crossover, and you get case two. But we're going to stick for the moment to case one. If A and B are right on top of each other, then crossing between them is negligible, and every meiosis takes path one, which means that we have 100% parentals. Well, if we have 100% parentals, what is the recombination frequency? Recombination frequency is 0 over the total, or 0%. So what we just said is that in this case, the recombination frequency approaches 0 because the parentals approach, the recombinants approach 0, the parentals approach 100%. So what would we say about linkage here? Linkage is tight or loose? This is tight linkage, and we would say that linkage approaches 100%. So that would give us this point right here. Now, what happens if A and B are not right on top of each other, but close? If A and B are close, then most meiosis are still type 1. No crossover between A and B. But there is an occasional crossover in between A and B. Maybe we should put what that means. That means you get a cut here and a rejoining crosswise so that you've switched. Whoops, I have to move my B. So we've switched the two A's relative to the B's. Now notice when crossing over occurs. Does it occur before DNA replication or after DNA replication? This is after. Two chromatids per chromosome. So that means any individual crossing over event only involves two of the four chromatids. So we're going to get two recombinant chromatids leading to two recombinant products of meiosis and two non-recombinant chromatids leading to two parentals. So if there's one crossover event, we're going to get half parentals and half recombinants. And it's important to notice when this crossing over occurred. We know, actually, it happened in prophase 1 of meiosis. You remember that crossing over requires two things. It requires homology and it requires enzymes. In diploid organisms, the homology is there all the time, but the enzymes are only present in prophase 1 of meiosis. There's one other feature of this picture worth noting. Every time I make a cut and a rejoin, I switch two pieces. So if I make a big A, little b, I have to make a little a, big B. Because if I cut these two loose ends, if everybody gets connected, either it's back the way it was before, or little b is connected to big A and little a to big B. So when you get one recombinant, you always get the other one. So people say that crossing over is reciprocal, which means that when you're counting up recombinants, usually you have approximately equal numbers of the two kinds. You have exactly equal in an individual meiosis, and in a sample from many meioses, it's approximately equal. Okay, so let's go back to our example here. If A and B are not right on top of each other, then most meioses are type 1, and a few meioses are type 2. So what are we going to end up with? We're still going to have mostly parentals. All parentals from here, half parentals from here. They have mostly parentals, but a few recombinants. So the RF is going to go up. The recombinants, in other words, go up. The parentals are going to go down. And linkage goes down. They aren't quite as closely linked. So we should maybe put a point here. Now, what happens if A and B are even further apart? What is the chance that a crossing over event will land between A and B? We know that crossing over isn't all that rare. But for it to fall in a particular interval often is. Because crossing over, say it occurs once per meiosis, per chromosome, could happen here, could happen here, could happen here, could happen here, could happen here. Now, what is the chance if I make one chop at random that it will fall between A and B? Here, it's virtually zero. Every chop I make is going to be outside. Here, there is some chance that I'll hit between A and B, but I'll probably hit outside. Now here, if I cut it random, do I have a higher or lower chance of ending up between A and B? I have a higher chance, larger target area. So I expect that as distance increases, the chance of a crossover occurring between A and B increases. These two are strictly linear. The more distance, the more crossing over. However, as we'll see, not all crossovers are detectable, and that's why this curve levels off. But strictly speaking, distance and crossover are always proportional. So what's going to happen here? A few more meioses are going to take path two. So we're going to have a lot of ones and a lot of twos. So what are we going to get now? We're going to get more recombinants, but still mostly parentals. So the number of recombinants is going to go up. Number of parentals is going to go down. And linkage is going to decrease a little bit. And the RF is going to increase. So it's going to be something like this. Now, as A and B get further and further apart, then the chance of a crossover between A and B gets higher and higher. However, if A and B get far enough apart, we have to worry about branch 3 on our handout, on the top. Last time, we considered possibility 1, no crossover at all. We considered possibility 2, one crossover. But we didn't consider possibility 3. Possibility 3 is that there is more than one crossover per meiosis. Now, what will be the results of that? There are multiple possibilities, depending on whether two chromatids do it twice, or two chromatids do it 3 times, or these two chromatids do it once, and those two chromatids do it once. There are many, many possibilities. For those of you who are curious, there is a picture in the notes of last time showing the details. But we're just going to lump it all together and say that if there are many crossover events, sometimes you'll get all parentals. Sometimes, why would you get all parentals? Because you cross over and you cross back again. Sometimes you get all recombinants, and sometimes you get half and half. All three are possible, and they're written out on your handout. But if you have many meioses with multiple crossovers, the net result is that half the time you end up with parentals, and half the time you end up with recombinants. Any individual meiosis can be all one or the other. But the total effect is half and half. Well, how does that affect things? If you can have multiple crossovers now, the actual number of crossovers goes up. But what happens to the recombination frequency? What happens to the number of recombinants that you recover? Some of your recombinants get crossed over and crossed back again. So you don't see them. You don't count them. So even though the number of crossovers goes up and up and up and up, the number of detectable ones begins to plateau. And so the curve starts to curve over until you get up to here. So what's happening here is you're starting to have multiple crossovers. In the linear part of the curve, you had only 0 or 1. But here, it's virtually all multiple crossovers. Now, what's that going to do to the recombination frequency? If virtually all of your meioses take path 3, you're not going to end up with all recombinants. You can end up with half recombinants and half parentals. So in fact, the A's and the B's are going to be distributed as if they were not connected, even though they're on the same chromosome, because they're so far apart. The A's and B's are going to get scrambled. So the RF approaches 50%, which means that linkage approaches zero. And once the things get far apart enough, doesn't matter if they're further, the result is the same. Now, there's another way of explaining why recombination frequency is 50% if things are too far apart. In other words, why does this situation give you 50% recombination? Let's draw it again, where everybody can see it. What happens if you get many, many crossovers in a meiosis? Well, that's equivalent to doing it. There are so many crossovers that it's randomized, whether big A comes out connected to big B or big A comes out connected to little b. So they act exactly the same as if they weren't connected at all. And you get the equivalent, you get independent assortment. Either A has an equal chance of going with either B, even though they're on the same chromosome. So in this case, we say that A and B are not genetically linked. Even though A and B are on the same chromosome, they're not genetically linked. Now, there's a little table in your handout that summarizes it. It's a variation on this. And I think that's really all I want to say about this issue, unless there are questions. Yeah?
With spontaneous reversions, is that where it's crossing over and the DNA is not rejoined and then it goes right back? Or is it rejoined and then...
Your question is, what is a spontaneous reversion? A spontaneous reversion is when you have a mutant or an alteration of some type, and it is corrected back to normal. And it can be corrected by crossing over or by repair mechanisms. But as long as, usually it doesn't mean by crossing over, it means by some kind of repair.
And then if we have a crossing over event and then another, is the DNA rejoined or is it not?
If you have one crossing over and then another, each time you have a crossing over event, you cut the two DNAs and rejoin them, either crosswise or back the way they were. Which is a good time to mention something which is a little further in your notes, but it's an important feature of the crossing over business. And that's to consider what one of the consequences of double crossing over. If two chromatids cross over twice, let's say they look like this. This is the example later in your notes. One crossover would be, say, here. And that would generate big A, little BC, and little a, big BC. Another crossover would be here. Now, if we have only the second crossover, what would we get? Big A, big B, little c. And little a, little b, big c. Now, what's going to be the relative frequency of these two? That's going to depend on the distance between A and B and the distance between B and C, which we don't know. On the other hand, there is another possibility. And that is that both of these crossovers will occur in the same meiosis. Now notice, each of these is a cut and rejoin event, two separate ones. But what they generate is big A, little b, big C, and little a, big b, little c. Now this took two events, not one. There is no mechanism for going chomp and taking out a B and slapping it on the other chromosome. You have to cut and rejoin twice. If that's true, how does the frequency of these two compare to the others? It took one rare event to get these two. It took one rare event to get this one. But it took two rare events to get the two I drew last. So this is going to be rarer. This is going to be smaller. The probability of the double recombinant is the product of the product of the probability of each single recombinant. So even though we don't know the distance from A to B or B to C, we can say the double recombinants will be rarer than either single recombinant. And this turns out to be useful in figuring out order. Because if I've got my order right, I know which two of the six is going to be the rarest. If the order is different, it'll be a different one. Okay. Yes?
Is there some mechanism such that the crossing over events only happen at a particular region in the DNA molecule? Okay.
Are crossing over events restricted to a particular region in the DNA molecule? More or less, no. There may be some slightly more favored places than others, but in general, we think that recombination can occur anywhere. It doesn't just occur between genes, it can occur within genes. It can occur essentially anywhere along the DNA. Yeah?
What's the relative size of the gene to the spaces between the genes?
What's the relative size to the gene with the spaces between the gene? Well, in bacteria, the gene is fairly large compared to the spaces between them. In eukaryotes, it may be reversed. But on the other hand, genes can be the coding part of a gene, the exons together, are quite small compared to the space. But the exons are small compared to the introns. So if you call the genes the whole thing, all the exons and the introns, that compares favorably with the spaces between genes. But it is true that in the DNA of higher organisms such as yourself, there is more junk DNA than there is important DNA. And it may be that most crossing over events fall in the junk DNA and therefore do not need to have exact joins. Yeah?
So, by arbitrarily choosing an order, you determine whether or not that order is correct by the frequency of the...
His question is, by arbitrarily determining and guessing at an order, can then you tell if that order is correct or not by the relative frequencies? And the answer is yes. Yeah.
Crossing over happens so often between the genes. Why isn't it happening in the middle of the gene?
If crossing over happens so often between genes, why doesn't it happen within genes? It does. Normally, it's not detected. In very large genes that have a lot of introns, you can detect a crossing over within the gene. So let's now consider, if you have some recombination frequency values, what can you do with them? How do you make a genetic map? Now, you could start with a double heterozygote, such as we have here. And you could look at the products of meiosis and classify them as parental or recombinant. Alternatively, you could start with a double, you need a double heterozygote with one difference, some difference at one point, and another difference at another. You can also have a double heterozygote, and when you're looking not at genes, but at spots in the DNA where there are changes, differences, mutations, or polymorphisms. So that I'll draw the DNA like this, the way we did for complementation and recombination. You're assuming there's some difference in the sequence at the position of one X and some difference in the sequence at the other X. This is also a double heterozygote. Now, we know in the offspring from AB, in the haploids, how to count them as recombinant or parental. But if this double heterozygous mutant goes through meiosis, what would be a parental and what would be a recombinant? So you can get... Now, which of those are parentals? The top two are parentals. No crossing over incurred in between the two mutations. On the other hand, the bottom two are recombinants. Remember, recombination is reciprocal. So if we have a cut and a rejoin in between, we will end up with a double mutant or a no mutant, depending on which one we're looking at. Now, as you'll see in many of the problems, sometimes you only count the one that has no mutations because it has a different phenotype and it's easy to detect. But if you know how many of these there are, you can infer how many of these, even if you can't count them. Okay, so suppose we do something like this and we get some numbers. So let's say we start with meiosis. We measure the recombination frequency between A and B. We take an organism like this and put it through meiosis, and we count recombinants and parentals, and we get 14%. What would be recombinants here? Big A, little b, and little a, big B are recombinants, and we get 14% recombinants. So, it's customary to say that if things have 1% recombination between them, they are one map unit apart. So in the linear part of the curve, 1% recombination frequency equals one map unit, also sometimes known as a centimorgan, in honor of Dr. Morgan, who started the study of all of this and who worked in Schermerhorn Hall with fruit flies. And in fact, the exact way of making maps was figured out by his undergraduate student here named Sturtevant. But unfortunately, the unit is named after the mentor and not after Sturtevant. It's named the centimorgan. Someone tried to introduce a unit called the sturt, but it didn't catch on. So these two, A and B, are located, by definition, 14 map units or centimorgans apart. But now you do another cross. You generate a BC, big B, a BC heterozygote, and now you look at recombinants. What would recombinants be this time? They'd have to be big B, big C, and little b, little c, and let's say you get 4%. So what does that tell you? Where is C relative to B? It is four map units away. But we don't know whether C is here or whether C is here. But we do know that C is four map units from B. Let me show you this one. How are we going to tell? We have to measure the distance between C and A. We've already done B and A. We've done B and C. Now we have to do C and A. So we have to generate a double heterozygote for C and A and look at the recombination frequency. Now, what is going to be the difference? If we do CA, what are we going to get? If C is out here, C to A is going to be 18 map units, and I'll get 18% recombination frequency. But if C is here, I'm going to get 10 map units and 10% recombination frequency. What I have just said is in the linear part of that curve, since recombination frequency is proportional to distance, recombination frequencies add, just like distances do. Generally, if you have RF values less than 25%, it's assumed that most meioses are either one or two, and I can ignore the threes, and my distances are approximately additive. Now, the law, bigger the distance, the bigger the deviation from linearity. And if you take genetics, you learn how to make corrections, but we're not going to worry about that. But we know that maps aren't totally linear because when distances get too large, you have to worry about case three.
Is that 50 map units?
Excuse me?
Is that 50 map units? Or the recombinants get struck 50%?
What we're saying here, his question is when does linearity fall off? Linearity falls off quite gradually. So what we're saying is you really want to stick, say, to this part of the curve, less than 25%. Because what happens is the curve doesn't look like this. The curve falls off gradually. And so you have to stick to this part. You don't abruptly go to 50% recombination. Now there is one more piece of the recombination business that we have to take care of. We have said that to measure recombination frequency, you start with a double heterozygote, and you look at the products of meiosis. These are haploids, and you classify them as parental or recombinant. Well, you can do that with some organisms because the haploids are spores. They can be grown up, and they can be tested for their properties, for their phenotype, and their phenotype, since they're haploid, is the same as their genotype. But what about with people? We want to know, does the gamete carry big A, little B, or big A, big B, or little A, little B? Can you tell from looking at a gamete? First of all, whoever tests the gamete. We can't get individual gametes, and we certainly can't test them for blue eyes and stuff like that. So what you do instead with diploids is you get the gametes form zygotes, and the zygotes grow up. And then you test the zygote, or the organism that comes from it. But now you're looking at a diploid, and you have to reason back to what haploids made that diploid. Now, it isn't as bad as it looks, because there's a way of keeping it simple. We just said, to put it another way, every diploid organism has two parents. So meiosis leading to crossing over could have occurred in this parent. Meiosis leading crossing over could have happened in that parent. And now I'm the product. How do I reason it back? In experimental crosses, you cheat. You use one parent who is homozygous recessive for all genes in question. Therefore, any big A's that turn up, we know where they came from. They came from the other parent. Anytime one parent is homozygous recessive for all the genes in question, it's called a test cross. Now, the other parent is a double heterozygote. Depending on how we set it up, either big AB slash little AB, or big A little B slash little AB, big B. Could be either one. Which one shall we do? The top or the bottom? Okay, we'll do the top. So let's do this one. Big AB, little AB, cross, double homozygous recessive. Now, when we think about gametes, if there's crossing over in the recessive parent, will we know?
No.
We can ignore it totally, because it doesn't make any difference. All we have to worry about is crossing over in the other parent. Second of all, we can get phenotype tells us genotype of the diploid, and that tells us the genotype of the gamete. Now, to give an example, suppose you get an organism from this which has double dominant phenotype. We can look at this two ways. What goes in the blank? There's only one thing you can get from this parent, and that's little AB. To put it another way, what two gametes met each other to give you this individual? Well, what do we get from the second parent? Little AB. That's easy. What did we get from the other parent? We must have gotten big A, big B to give the big A, big B phenotype. So we know right off the bat that a big A, big B met a little A, little B. So in terms of meiosis from our heterozygous parent, what gamete did they produce? Parental or recombinant? What's this? This is parental. So from looking at the diploids, you infer back what gametes came from this parent, you count them up parental recombinant, and you get a recombination frequency. Now, how to do this is outlined in detail on handout 23C, which is not here. You don't have it. It's online. And there are links to it in the notes. It just says exactly what I said, but it explains it in more detail, and it gives you an actual example with all the parts, so you can try it yourself. Now, this basically wraps it up for linkage. So I want to change subjects now and talk about population genetics, but let me ask first what questions there are. Yeah.
Just trying to do a problem. I know sometimes you multiply them in combination frequency by 2 to get the mass units.
This business of multiplying recombination frequency by 2 to get map units is because you're only counting these and not both classes. And you'll see now when you try and do those problems, I think they'll make a lot more sense. Okay. Now, I'm going to leave this because the only way to really understand this is to do the problems. And I want to change the topic considerably. Until now, we've been talking largely about how cells work, with an emphasis on prokaryotes. And now I want to consider a little bit about how did things get to be the way they are. For example, why is cystic fibrosis more common in whites, and sickle cell disease is more common in blacks? Why is it that drug resistance spreads, but cytochrome C change stays essentially the same? Your cytochrome C and that of a broccoli are very similar. Only about half the amino acids are the same, but the 3D shape is virtually identical, and the function is identical. So why do some things change, some things stay the same, some things are found in one part of the world, other things are found in another? How does that work? Now, the short answer is that almost all of this is explained by evolution, by natural selection. That is, that all living things are descended from a common ancestor by modification due to mutation, followed by selection. That's the short answer. And we're going to explain some of how that works, but I think it's easier to look at it the other way around. That is, what are the conditions under which there is no change at all? Let's look at that. And then we'll ask, what are the conditions that lead to change? Now, in order to do this, we have to look at populations and not individuals, because the things that I'm talking about are population phenomena. Different populations are different from others. How is that? So let's consider a single specific case, and then we'll generalize. We know how you specify the genotype of an individual. How do you specify the genotype of a population? So let's take an example. Let's take a population where everybody is heterozygous for gene A. Well, there are only two alleles here to be had, big A and little a. What are the proportions or the frequencies of big A and little a? Well, if everybody is big A, little a, then half the alleles are big A and half the alleles are little a, and that's that. So the frequency of big A is a half or 0.5, and the frequency of little a is a half. Now, how do you describe this population? To get its genotype, you have to know the proportion of big A and little a, and then you have to know in what combinations do they occur. What are the genotypes of individuals? Well, if you have big A and little a, there are only three possibilities. You can be big A, little a, little a, or big A, little a. Now, in this population, what's the frequency of big A, big A? Everybody's big A, little a. We're not talking about the next generation, not yet. We're talking about this population. It's zero. There aren't any. And the frequency of little a is zero. And the frequency of big A, little a is 100% or 1. That's our starting condition. But as somebody started to tell me, in the next generation, it's going to be different. What is it going to be in the next generation? Well, if everybody's big A, little A, there's only one kind of marriage or mating that you can do. Big A, little A has to do it with big A, little A. There isn't anybody else. So all the crosses are going to be heterozygote cross heterozygote. So what are we going to get in the next generation? Well, what does this give you? Gives you big A again, big A, little A, and little A, little A. In what proportions?
Quarter.
It's a quarter, a half, a quarter. So in fact, we know that in the next generation, that's what we're going to get. Oh, and what are the proportions of big A and little A? Notice they're the same. They're still half and half. All right, this is pretty boring. What about the next generation? Well, if I had to, if I locked you in a room, you could do it. You could do big A, cross big A, big A. You can figure out how often that happens, and you know what their offspring are. Well, but maybe big A meets big A, little A. Well, you can figure out how often that happens, and you know what their offspring are. You could go through each combination. You know how likely it is. You know what the offspring are. You could get the result. But to do that, you have to make certain assumptions. You're making the assumption that a chance a big A will meet a big A, little A is just equal to their proportions in the population. That's called random mating. It's random who you do it with. But you also have to assume that everybody is equally likely to do it. Everybody is equally likely to have offspring, and every combination has equal numbers of offspring. And that's called no selection. So who you do it with is random, but your probability of ever doing it is the same for everybody, and the number of offspring is the same for everybody. So the chance that I pass on my genes, the chance that you pass on your genes, it's all the same. Now there's one other thing you have to do here. In order for this to come out, you have to have a large population. If you have a small population, you won't get close to a quarter, a half, a quarter. To have a statistical proportions that match the expected, you have to have a large population. Well, if all three of those are true, there's a much easier way to get the answer. I don't have to do one cross at a time. I can say to myself, if all that is true, all I need to know is that half the alleles are big A and half the alleles are little a. So I have what is usually called the gene pool. I have like a big pot with all the alleles in it. And I have half with big A and half with little a. You know, it's like the New Jersey lottery drum, you know. So I have a big pot, or gene pool, and in this case I have about equal numbers of pink and green triangles. One of them has big A on it, one has little a. So if I mix this up properly, which is what random mating is, and now I pick two honestly and blindly without cheating, what is the chance I will get two pinks or two little A's? It's a quarter because half of them are little a, right? So the chance is a half, I'll get a pink one. If I do it again, the chance is a half, I'll get a pink one. So it's a half times a half or a quarter that I'll get two pinks in a row. So in fact, one quarter will be little a. Now what's the chance of getting two greens or a big A, big A? Same thing. What's the chance of getting a heterozygote? Well, why is it not the same? Well, what's the chance of picking green and then pink? Half times a half, right? But what's the chance of picking a pink and then green? That's also a half times a half. There are two ways to get a heterozygote. I can pick pink and then green, or green and then pink, and each of those is a quarter too. So a half are going to be heterozygous. What did I just figure out? I figured out that in the next generation, if all those conditions are met, I'm going to have a quarter, a half, a quarter, which is exactly the same. If I allowed complete random mixing, then I get the steady state proportions, and they're just going to stay the same from generation to generation. I have reached in one generation what is called genetic equilibrium. Genetic equilibrium is what you get when all those conditions are met. And therefore, given the proportions of little a and big A, you know the proportions of big A, little a, and little a, little a. Now, we just did it for a specific example, which was picked because the math is easy. We assumed that you started out with half big A and half little a. Oh, what if I had started out with, instead of everybody big A, big A, I had started with one half little a, and one half big A, big A. It would have come out exactly the same. Because what's critical is that half the alleles are big A and half the alleles are little a. And once I let them mix randomly, I'm going to get this combination, and it's going to stay the same from generation to generation. But there is no rule that big A and little a have to be equally likely. I don't know about blue and brown eyes, which allele is more common and which is less. But I do know that, say, for Huntington's or cystic fibrosis, one allele is very common and the other allele is very rare. But there is something I know. If there are two alleles of the gene, whatever one is, everything is one or the other. So the frequency of the two has to add up to one. It could be half and half. It could be 0.7, 0.3. It could be 0.999 and 0.0001. But whatever the two frequencies of the alleles are, they have to add up to one. Now, I think this is diagrammed on your handout. Yes, on the back, on the other side. The general statement of this is called the Hardy-Weinberg law, after the two people who came up with it simultaneously, where, as we've said before, f of big A is the frequency of one allele, f of little a is the frequency of the other allele. Now, in our first example, the frequencies were half and half. But it's customary to call one of these p and the other one q. The frequency of the two alleles is p and q. Now, what we just said is we know that p plus q equals 1, whatever the values are. But that's it. So we have a pot with pink and green, but the pinks and greens aren't necessarily equally. P is the proportion of pinks, say, and q is the proportion of greens. Now, if that's true, when we reach into the pot, what's the chance of getting two big A's? It's just p squared. Because if, say, this is 1/10, that means 1/10 of the markers have big A on them. So I have a 1/10 chance of getting big A the first time, a 1/10 the second time. So p squared is going to be the proportion or the frequency of homozygous big A. Now, similarly, q squared is going to be the chance of homozygous little a. But what's going to be the chance of getting a heterozygote? What's the chance that I'll get big A and then little a? Well, big A is P, little a is Q. So that's PQ. What's the chance, though, that I'll get little a and then big A? That's Q times P. Same thing. So the chance of getting a heterozygote is actually 2PQ, because there are two ways of doing it. Now, we know one more thing. We know that you have a p squared chance of getting homozygous big A, q squared of little a, 2pq of heterozygous. But considering everybody in the population, everybody is one of these three. Therefore, what do these three have to add up to? One. So p squared plus 2pq plus q squared equals one. Now, this is called the Hardy-Weinberg law. And if your values fit the Hardy-Weinberg law, you're in genetic equilibrium, which means that they won't change. And if they don't fit, you're not in genetic equilibrium. Now, when you see this the first time, people usually have one of two responses. So p plus q equals 1, and you square both sides, and you get p squared plus 2p plus q squared equals 1. For this, they're famous. What's the big deal? Seems obvious. On the other hand, if you're not happy with math, you go, oh my God, math. Now, what I want to try and convince you is that this is not totally trivial, and it's not all that difficult either. So I want to do some examples to show how you use it. And these examples are on your hand. Maybe we should say first what the absolute significance of this is. This says if you have big A and little a in the population at some proportions, this says that as long as the conditions listed here are met, what happens to the proportions of big A and little a? They don't change. Big A doesn't drive out little a and take over. Little a doesn't disappear. That's one of the big consequences of this idea. This says that if you have genetic equilibrium, if these conditions are met, then you don't lose little a. It can remain around and be passed on from generation to generation. And what this follows from is something that we haven't said, but is understood, that when a heterozygote makes gametes, does it favor passing on little a or big A? Or neither? Neither. That both of these have an equal chance of being passed on. Even though the phenotype may be total big A, little a gets passed on. And the Hardy-Weinberg law is a consequence of that fact. And this means that variation doesn't mix in, it's not lost, and it's around for natural selection to act on. And that's one of the main significances of the Hardy-Weinberg law. But the way you use the Hardy-Weinberg law is that if you have some of these values, you can tell if the population's in genetic equilibrium or not, and so you know what should happen in the future. On the other hand, if you know that the population is in genetic equilibrium, then you can apply these formulas and figure out things that you would like to know. So let's take the first example where it says how to use frequencies assuming equilibrium. For cystic fibrosis, as far as we know, the population is in genetic equilibrium. And that the chance of a person having it hasn't changed over a long time. The proportion of the population with cystic fibrosis has remained steady. So the question is, can you use that information? We know we're in genetic equilibrium, more or less, for this condition. Now, we know who has cystic fibrosis. You can tell they have symptoms. But how many people are carriers? Can you tell from looking? No. We don't know of the healthy people walking around what proportion are carriers. But you can actually figure that out using the Hardy-Weinberg law. And we know that 1 in 2,000 live births are people with cystic fibrosis. Now, this is a recessive condition. So we know the frequency of little le, little a, is 1 in 2,000. That means that's q squared. Q squared is 1 in 2,000, so Q is the square root of that number. Now, without doing the algebra, which you can check when you get home, if you know Q, do you know P? Yeah, because they have to equal 1. And if you know Q and P, then you can calculate the number of heterozygotes. It's 2PQ. And the surprising result of all this is that one person in 25, approximately, is a carrier of cystic fibrosis. So that means in this room, maybe there are, 100 people in this room? There are probably 4 carriers in this room. So the point of this is the incidence of carriers is not negligible. There are a lot of carriers. And there's another calculation here of how many there are in the United States, and this is an old handout which I forgot to update. So there aren't 250 million people in the United States, there are 300 million people in the United States. So there are over 10 to the 7 carriers walking around. Now this means that it would be very useful to be able to test for this condition. At the moment, there isn't a totally good test for it. If the company that invents it will make money, and they will do societal good, and you can figure that out from the number of carriers. The reason it's hard to come up with a test for this is that a carrier doesn't have an unusual phenotype that is easily measured, and the genotypes of all carriers are not the same. We talk about there being big A alleles and little a alleles, but it turns out all little a's aren't the same. What they have in common is they don't code for a functional protein. But the mutation in them is not always the same. And as a result, to detect the DNA directly is difficult because you don't know what to test for. 75% of the little a's are the same, but the other 25 is a collection of miscellaneous ones. So no one yet has come up with a good test to find out if a person is big A, little a for sure, or big A, big A. But when they do, this will be a test worth taking, probably. Now, some people may not wish to take it. They may not wish to change their childbearing options as a result of this, but some people may. Okay, so one way to use this is if you know, for example, how many people are little a, you can figure out the frequency of the allele and how many people are carriers. Another way to do, maybe before we should leave this though, how could we be in genetic equilibrium for cystic fibrosis? Well, maybe there's random mating, and maybe there's no selection. No selection? People who are little a don't reproduce. So in fact, clearly there's selection. And we do have a large population. So since little a people don't reproduce, why hasn't little a eventually died out? There are 2 answers to this. One is that most of the little a's are in heterozygotes, and they are protected. They have no effect. And the other answer is that we do lose a few little a's, from selection. But we also get a few little a's, from something we left off, and that's mutation. In order for this to work, we're assuming no mutation. One way to get genetic equilibrium is for all of these to be true. The other way to get genetic equilibrium is if some deviations in one balance out deviations in the other. Genetic equilibrium is like chemical equilibrium. It doesn't mean there are no forces pushing things around. It just means the push in one direction is equal to the push in the other direction. So the net change is zero. So we think with CF, there's a small conversion of big A to little a by mutation and a small loss of little a from non-reproduction. And they balance each other out, and so we have genetic equilibrium. So genetic equilibrium can be because they're all true or because they balance out. Now we want to do one more example, which is the one that I've written up here for eminent. How do you check if a population is in equilibrium? Now, this is the real population in the United States. These are the real proportions. This is a property, eminent or codominant alleles of the same gene, as we explained last time, and these are proteins on the surface of your red blood cells. And the good thing here is that you can detect directly homozygous M, homozygous N, and heterozygote. So you can measure all 3. And now you can ask, are the proportions what you would expect of the Hardy-Weinberg law? Are we in genetic equilibrium? So how do you do that? You use these numbers to calculate what should P and Q be. If this one, for example, is, say, P squared, and this one is Q squared, this one should be 2pq. So you see, can I find a value of p and q that works? Well, if this is, if p squared is 0.3, then p is the square root of 0.3. This is worked out in your handout, which is approximately 0.55. So that would be the frequency of m. According to that, that would be the frequency of m. And the frequency of n, by similar reasoning, is 0.45. Is this okay? If we're in genetic equilibrium, how should p and q be related? They should add up to 1. In fact, they always add up to 1. They have to add up to 1. And here, they do. Using this fits the proportions expected. To put it another way around, if these are the values of p and q, then this is p squared, 2pq, and q squared. Everything fits. We're in genetic equilibrium. Now, the first time you hear this, it sounds phony. There are just too many variables. How can it fail to fit? Of course it works. So I've made up an example here that doesn't work on purpose. Let's suppose you find a population where the proportions are 25%, 60%, 15%. Can you find a value of p and q such that this is p squared, this is 2pq, and this is q squared? And the answer is you can't. Now, how do you see that? Well, you try the Hardy-Weinberg. If mm is 0.25, m should be the square root of 0.25 or 0.5. So in that case, m and n should each be 0.5, right? But then what should be the proportion here? 0.25. This does not fit. So this population is not in genetic equilibrium. But what are the proportions here? What is the genotype of this population? We know the proportions of the various genotypes, but what's the proportion in the pot of M, allele L, M, and allele N? You can't find it using the Hardy-Weinberg law, because that only applies if you're in genetic equilibrium. So how do you get it? You do it by the Seen-Lacanze or the bean counter method. You say, out of every 100 people, 25 are MM, 50 are MN, and 15 are NN. Therefore, I can just count it up. Because there are 2 alleles in this person, 2 alleles in this person, and 2 alleles in this person. One way of thinking about it is each person gets 2 slips of paper. So this person writes M on both slips. This person writes N and M on one slip and M on the other. And this person writes M, N on both slips. And you put them all in a pot. And there'll be 200 slips. What is the chance of picking out an M? What is the chance of picking out an N? You just have to count. This calculation is done for you in the notes. And the net result, however, if you just count them, is that M equals 0.55 and N equals 0.45. You can't get that from the Hardy-Weinberg law. You can only get that by counting. Now, I picked this example because how does the proportion of M and N vary between these two? Notice these numbers are the same as these numbers. The proportion of the 2 alleles is the same. But here they come together in Hardy-Weinberg proportions. And here they don't. For this many M's and N's, there are too few NM's, too few MM's, and too many heterozygotes. And we don't have time to discuss why. But this is a population that is not in genetic equilibrium. Now, I very briefly want to consider populations that are not in genetic equilibrium. What gives? In other words, how is this all related to evolution? Evolution is often defined in a kind of reductionist definition. It's defined as the change in a genotype of the population. Genetic equilibrium is when the genotype stays the same. Evolution is when it changes. When it changes, what is the reason? Is it because of mutation? Is it because of non-random mating? Is it because of selection? Or is it because of chance effects and a small population? Now, the notes go through each of these carefully. We're not going to do so. And the problems that you will be assigned won't require that you know the fine points of all of these. But I want to explain the bottom line. We think that mutation combined with migration is actually the source of all variation. If there weren't any mutation, there wouldn't be any variation. But mutation, variation is there all the time, and what we're really interested in is why do some variations spread and some don't? So in the sort of pattern of evolution, we think you don't have to wait around for a particular mutation. Mutations are always there, but the question is which ones spread and which ones don't. Now, non-random mating means that you don't mix that pot very well. It means that who you do it with is not random, which is probably the case most of the time. Who you decide to marry, live with, whatever, is not likely to be totally random. You are likely to pick somebody of the same socioeconomic and educational class as you are. So non-random mating, we know, is significant. But it doesn't change what's in the pot. It only changes what combinations they occur in. This, in fact, could be a case of non-random mating, where opposites attract. And so you have too many heterozygotes. On the other hand, if birds of a feather stick together, you'll get too many homozygotes and not enough heterozygotes, but it won't change the proportion of alleles in the pot. So we're left with two other possibilities. When there are changes that occur, one possibility is it's due to selection, and the other it's due to chance. In small populations, you don't get statistically valid samples. If two heterozygotes marry and have four children, they're not going to be one homozygous dominant, one homozygous recessive, and two heterozygotes every time. So the proportions in a small population often deviate up or down just due to chance. And this is called genetic drift. And if you're interested in the details, it's in the notes. Now, there are other chance factors that affect evolution. If an asteroid hits the Earth, it doesn't wipe out the fit or the unfit preferentially. It's just whoever it lands on. And you could say something happens today when the crane falls, or the bridge at St. Louis Rye, that some chance events alter who's around, and they have nothing to do with fitness or capability. But we know that some variation from species to species and person to person is due to chance. But we know that a great deal of it is due to selection. This seems to be one of the major players. One way of asking how all of this works is to ask, over the change that has occurred over the past, which is responsible for living things today, what was responsible? What was the role of selection? Another way of looking at it is, given what we have today, if you look at the difference between each of us, or the difference between us and apes, how much of that difference is due to chance, and how much of that difference is due to selection? And we think that most, but by no means all of it, is due to selection. And the reason for that is that there's an awful lot of variation. That's obvious, look around. There's a lot of variation in this world, but it doesn't seem to be randomly distributed. The classic example is bears or giraffes. I like bears. There are bears with thick fur and bears with thin fur, bears with white fur and bears with brown fur. But they don't seem to be randomly distributed over the earth. The bears with the thick white fur seem to be in the Arctic, and the bears with the thin brown fur are preferentially in Yellowstone. Now, if it were random chance, it could be either way. But selection explains the current combination, because up north, if a bear is light-colored, the seals can't see it coming and it gets a good lunch. If it's dark-colored, the seals see it coming, they dive in the water, and the poor bear goes hungry. So there is strong selection for light-colored bears, meaning that light-colored bears are more likely to leave offspring than dark-colored bears. So they are more likely to pass on their genetic information. The similar thing goes for thick fur versus thin fur. The thin-furred bear in the Arctic freezes to death, but the thick-furred bear in Yellowstone dies of heat stroke. So there is selection in two different places for two different combinations. So we think that the general basic way everything works is that evolution works in a two-step process. That first you have mutation, which is more or less random with respect to where it occurs in the DNA and the effect it has on function. And then you have selection, which isn't random at all. And selection means contributing, it means reproductive success. It means contributing more than your fair share of your genes to the next generation. And as a result, the population composition changes. And the population changes to fit better to its environment, and that's called adaptation. Now, next semester, we're going to talk primarily not about prokaryotes, but about eukaryotes. We're going to talk about eukaryotic cells, and we're going to talk about eukaryotic multicellular organisms. And we're going to see at the protein and DNA level how this process works, because we're going to see many remains of this process of proteins and genes that mutated and were selected over many, many generations. And I think I'm going to wrap it up now. I'm not going to talk about any social implications, as your notes say. But I want to thank you all again for coming today. And I'll see you all probably at the final and certainly next semester.